This talk is listed as Evidence of Angels in our abstract. On the talk itself, it's called Rumors of Angels, and the subtitle is Intelligent Design and the Detection of Malevolent Spiritual Agents by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract, angels and similar spirit beings have been banished from the physical world, as far as most people are concerned, for some centuries now. Is this attitude warranted? How might the existence and activity of such beings be detected scientifically? Disappearance of angels. Angels are fairly common in biblical accounts, but they disappear with the rise of modern science, and they are now all ignored altogether in disciplines such as history or science. Even systematic theologies written in the past century don't devote much space to angels. I did a little survey of some of the systematic theologies in our library at Biblical Seminary, and typically angels get no space in liberal theologies. They don't get a lot of space in many evangelical theologies. The lowest are the theology by Hoeksema only has 0.5% of its space devoted to angels. So page counts, by the way. Charles Hodge's systematic theology gives 0.6%. J. Oliver Buswell, Jr.'s systematic theology gives 0.7%. The most space is given to angels in Wayne Grudem, 3.6%, Stanley Grentz, 4.5%, and Lewis Sperry Chafer, 4.6%. Still not much, huh? What's the reason for this? Perhaps this is a result of books such as Andrew Dixon White's book, The History of the Warfare of Science with Theology and Christendom. This was first published in 1896 and has been reprinted at least a couple of times since then, a Dover edition, and I believe Amazon now has an edition, and the book is still in print today. Andrew Dixon White, shown it right here, once president of Cornell University, one of the founders, and also was the U.S. ambassador to Russia at one point, shows us in his book how some ancients and medievals believe that angels produced weather, human disease, and insanity. He claims that science has now shown all these phenomena are the result of natural laws. As a result, scholars have tended to treat the idea of angelic activity as beneath contempt. Well, that leads us to our proposal. Our proposal is this, rather mediating. Those ancients who believed that angels produced all the phenomena of weather, disease, and insanity were mistaken, I suggest. But so, too, are those moderns who believe that angels are mythological or that angels produce no effects in the natural world. Rather, we suggest that angels exist and are able to, and do, interact with nature. So we look first of all at angelic action in nature according to the Bible. Angels in the Bible are mentioned on over 160 occasions. Angels are spirit beings of some sort. Not absolutely sure what we mean by that. Spirit, used in this sense, means non-material and is often contrasted in the Bible with flesh, usually understood to be immaterial. But spirit is also used to mean person in the Bible. So a spirit can equal a person without a body, or a spirit can equal the non-body part of a person who has a body. Angels, the word angel transliterates the Greek angelos. The Greek word is a generic word for messenger, not particularly for supernatural beings. In the Bible, however, it is usually found referring to a supernatural messenger from God. So the biblical use of angelos usually referring to messengers of God, and among those usually to superhuman messengers of God. The Hebrew has a corresponding word, malach, which has about the same range as the Greek word. We're not sure whether other supernatural beings in the Bible are to be classified under angel or not. Is Satan an angel? Are demons angels? are the seraphim and cherubim angels. Not sure. Not sure. Lots of people are sure, but we're not, not sure. For our purposes here, however, we will lump them together. So when we're speaking of angels in this whole thing, we're discussing that whole category. What about demons? I couldn't find much satisfactory in the way of a graphic, but we'll use this one, right? The term is used in the Bible, especially the New Testament, for some sort of spirit being which can inhabit humans and animals. Get in them and operate them in some way, perhaps like a driver of a car. They apparently are viewed as taking over the physical operations of their hosts. Some think demons are fallen angels. Others distinguish between the two groups. They're not good guys. The word demon actually is used in pagan Greek circles for kind of a smaller version of a god or a lesser god, something of that sort. Or sometimes even perhaps for the spiritual part of a human. But the Bible has this more specific use of the term. Satan is the English transliteration of the Hebrew word shatan, meaning adversary or accuser. It's used for a specific individual of a malevolent spirit sort. The Greek equivalent is diabolos, from which the English devil comes. And the generic meaning of diabolos is slanderer, malicious one. So the devil is the slanderer, the malicious one. We summarize our picture of angels. Angels are persons who are immaterial, or at least their connection with our world is different than ours is. So if they've got bodies of some sort, they're different kinds of bodies. What do they look like? Well, they can be invisible, and they can take on human appearance. We don't really know what they look like. Some are benevolent, that is, obedient to God, and others are malevolent, that is, in rebellion against God. What do angels do? Well, the name, Angelos Malach, suggests that they act as messengers for God. And we see plenty of examples of this in Scripture, a couple of samples. angel comes to Mary and gives her the message from God regarding her conception of Jesus. The angels come to the shepherds regarding the birth of Jesus. We're also told in Scripture that malevolent angels may pretend to give God's word. So Paul in Galatians 1 warns his readers that if an angel should come with a message different than the gospel that Paul has given him, you should consider that to be a malevolent angel, not a good guy, etc. Besides acting as messengers for God, we see in the Scripture angels bringing judgment on humans. So the angels bring judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah. They bring judgment on the firstborn of Egypt at the last of the 10 plagues. Thirdly, angels can rescue or protect humans. So Jesus, after his temptation, is nourished in the wilderness by angels. Peter and the apostles are rescued from prison by angels. So, angelic activity, the Bible pictures angels as able to produce physical effects, and is actually doing so. They open gates, as in the rescue of Peter. They provide food, as in nourishing Jesus. They influence the course of human history. We have reference to the Prince of Persia and the Prince of Greece in Daniel chapter 8, I believe that is. They influence the course of human history on the individual level and on the collective level. Demonic activity. Demons can inhabit humans. Since we have nothing explicitly said about angels in this regard, that's one reason we don't know for sure that angels and demons are the same beings or not. Demons can inhabit humans and drastically affect their lives. And they can drastically affect others around them. Demons can inhabit animals. We have considerably less information given here, but that of the pigs running down the slope and drowning in the account in the Gospels. Demons appear to be involved in pagan worship. And we're not sure exactly how this operates, Both the Old and New Testament seem to indicate demonic connection with pagan worship. Probably one mode I think that we can be feel fairly certain about is that possession of priests and priestesses and prophets and such is one mode here. Satanic activity. Satan can converse with humans, influencing their actions. Satan can produce physical effects. Job 1, we see him bringing down fire from heaven, calling up a wind out of the desert, guiding two raiding parties, and timing the arrival of the four messengers from these disasters that he brings on Job, so that they will build the effect and come one right after the other, building up to the climax in which Job's children are killed. Job 2, we see that Satan is able to strike Job with disease. If we try to summarize the material about angels, demons, and Satan, we can say that angels, demons, and Satan can produce physical effects in our world. They can act through humans. They can act more directly without human agency. So, that's our tour of the biblical material on angels, more specifically angels, demons, and Satan. What about science and angels? Think about detecting angels scientifically. How can we detect the actions of beings that, like angels, are invisible at will? Actual observation of such beings will not be repeatable, so the evidence is going to be only anecdotal. The things that we could study would be the natural effect that these beings produce. You might not even be able to see them produce it. By analogy, consider how scientists would expect to detect extraterrestrial intelligences. Well, detecting terrestrial intelligence, early in the space age, weather satellite photos were used to look for signs of intelligence on Earth. Point of this was that scientists were thinking about, well, how would we detect intelligent life on other planets? And the first thing that they thought might be able to test is, we've now got some pictures looking down on the Earth from their first satellites up there. Can we detect signs of intelligence on Earth using these things, assuming we didn't know it already? Well, because of the limited sensitivity and resolution of these early pictures, they're daylight pictures only and not very good resolution, the only evidence that was found on these pictures was a massive logging operation in Canada. So, I think we can pick up a principle from the attempts to detect terrestrial intelligence on Earth at a distance. Intelligent activity might be at work, but we might not have the tools to detect it. Another example comes from the so-called Mars head. An early flyby of Mars photographed an object that looked like a huge head staring back into space. See a picture of this on the right. Much was made of this by some people, not by NASA, in the following years. Recently, pictures were taken at the same site at higher resolution and with a different sun angle. These showed that the head was only a fluke of observation, rather like seeing objects in clouds or objects in ink blots, and that with a full illumination, etc., the uncanny appearance of a head rather disappeared and looked like you got kind of a damaged half of a mask or something of that sort. So, a lesson from the Mars head. We too might see what looks like intelligent activity, but is really not. This, of course, is what Richard Dawkins, in his work The Blind Watchmaker, claims for all apparent design in living things. I think he's mistaken, and addressed that question to a certain extent in my PowerPoint talk, The Creation-Evolution Debate, Recent Developments. Third example, Salmonella in Oregon. Some years ago, there was an epidemic of Salmonella in Wasco County, Oregon. Some health officials suspected the followers of Guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, who had a large group living nearby. They were unable, however, to find convincing evidence that the epidemic wasn't natural. However, later, some cult members confessed, the community was searched, and it turned out the group had been developing a germ warfare program and had tried it out by putting some of the stuff in salad bars in the neighboring restaurants in Wasco County, Oregon. Even a large effect might be seen as natural when it isn't, is a principle we can derive from this particular one. Over 1,000 people were struck by salmonella in this particular county, way above the statistical likelihood. And yet, the observers, at least the official observers, saw it as natural until they got some other evidence. Even a large effect might be seen as natural when it isn't. Another example comes from unknown artifacts. Back in 1980-81, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington had an exhibit of unidentified artifacts. These were not alien artifacts, but items made in the 19th century. Not even curators knew what all of them had been made for. So, a principle we can gain from this, products of intelligent design might only be recognized by evidence of artifice without realizing what they were made for, without being able to determine what they were made for. So, after that little tour on looking at the questions of intelligent design and such, we come back to the question, how might we find scientific evidence for angelic activity? Well, here we're going to suggest that angelic activity does not operate continuously like natural laws do. Rather, angels, being persons, would interact with nature sporadically, rather as we humans do. We're not thinking about how humans are interacting with nature in the sense of what's going on in ourselves, but in the sense of how we're interacting with our surroundings. If this is so, then the angels probably would not be detected by being observed while they're actually doing something. That would presumably be quite rare. Rather, they might be detected through long-lasting effects of their actions. But in any case, we're not trying to detect all of the actions of these beings, only some of them. We're trying to do, if you like, an existence proof rather than a surveillance. Would angelic actions leave unmistakable traces? Well, this is just the sort of thing the methods of intelligent design movement should be able to detect. William Dembski, Michael Behe, and others have developed tools for distinguishing the work of intelligent agents from purely natural phenomena. Behe's technique is to look for irreducible complexity. Dembski's approach is to look at the phenomena and seek to eliminate natural law and random phenomena, if you like. Dembski shows how one can distinguish between events that are either random or law-bound or intentional. Such an approach, as sketched by Dembski, has been used in some branches of science for many years. In anthropology and archaeology, this is a technique, if you like, that such scientists use to distinguish artifacts from natural products. To look at a chipped stone and try and decide whether it's chipped because it fell off the side of a cliff and bounced a couple of times, or whether it has been shaped by an intelligence seeking perhaps to make a hand axe or an arrowhead or something of that sort. And, of course, if they finish the job, that's a pretty easy call. But if the thing is left with relatively few strokes, the call might not be all that easy. Another area in which this sort of technique is used scientifically is what we call forensics, the attempt to detect crime in medical situations particularly. How to recognize murder in the cases of suspicious death. Is this a natural phenomenon? Is this something that is involving intelligence? Also, to detect cheating. Cheating taking place in gambling. Cheating taking place in scientific research. So, cheating taking place in academic work. In academic work, I've been a professor for many years and grading papers, term papers, and things of that sort. And sometimes you can spot cheating very, very easily. Other times it would be very tough to tell, and teachers in general don't have the time to do research on that sort of thing. But when you see the character of the English in your paper suddenly switch back and forth rather drastically, one gets a suspicion that maybe there's been some cut and paste work going on here. And then if you can actually locate the site of it, such as perhaps doing a Google search on the phrase, and you suddenly find it came out of the middle of a paper, and careful examination shows other stuff came from there as well, you're able to detect cheating in academic work. So what you're looking at is the probabilities of those things being accidental. Essentially, this method involves detecting highly improbable features which fit a pattern. The intelligent design movement suggests that a superhuman intellect is at work in the fine-tuning of the universe's basic forces. In the rarity of truly Earth-like environment, the fine-tuning of the universe's basic forces, see, for instance, Paul Davies' Accidental Universe, or Barrow and Tipler, the anthropic cosmological principle, or Hugh Ross's Creator in the Cosmos, the rarity of a truly Earth-like environment, see Ross's Creator in the Cosmos, or see the work Rare Earth, the apparent design of living things. So the intelligent design movement suggests a superhuman intellect is at work in the fine-tuning universe's basic forces, the rarity of a truly Earth-like environment, the apparent design of living things. Though the intelligent design movement is cautious about the nature of this intellect, the remark by the late Sir Fred Hoyle is suggestive. Hoyle, looking at some of these fine-tuning things, says in his work, The Universe, Past and Present Reflection, a super-intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. Well, that's an interesting remark. I remember in my teaching apologetics for many years that occasionally you would hear a person say, well, apologetics of this evidential sort is no good because it can never prove an infinite God. Well, yes, finite beings would have a great deal of difficulty telling whether something was infinite or whether it was just very, very large, near infinity of some sort. But I should point out that the evidence that Hoyle finds that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology does suggest to us that the super intellect certainly puts the pagan gods Thor, Zeus, and Jupiter in the shade. Well, how would we distinguish between different sources of intelligent design? Are there levels of intelligent design? How would we distinguish, for example, between God and angels, demons, and Satan, and humans? God, after all, is infinite in power and intelligence. Angels, demons, and Satan are finite in power and intelligent, and humans are also finite in these things, but presumably with less power and intelligence than angels. Well, one way would be to try and list on the chart the agent on the left-hand side, the power or scale of the agent's activity, the character of the agent's activity, the quality of the agent's activity, and then an example of the agent's activity. So we put God up at the top of this list. God is unlimited in the power and scale of his work. His character is good. Quality of his work would be perfect. An example, presumably, would be fine-tuning of the basic forces. Angels would have large power and scale, and if we're thinking of unfallen angels, good character, but the quality of their work compared to God's would be imperfect. What might an example be? Demons would work on a large scale, perhaps, as well. Their character would be evil. Quality of their work would be imperfect. What will we see there? Humans, small power and scale, character of both good and evil, quality, imperfect. Example, a human artifact. So the two question marks in the chart is, what might an angelic artifact look like, and what might a demonic or fallen angel artifact look like? Good question. Well, we need to think a little bit about angelic capabilities to think about the character, the power and scale of their activities. What might be some examples that lie within the range of angelic capabilities? Well, of course, that will depend on angelic capabilities. That angels are finite doesn't tell us a whole lot, since the universe itself appears to be finite. Finite can be very, very big or very, very small. Can angels influence events on the scale of the cosmos? Galaxy, solar system, Earth, or just below that level? Well, one way to think about this is to come at it from the biblical text and see what hints we get there. We don't get a lot of information, but we do have Satan calling up a fierce wind, obviously at least being able to influence local weather, and Satan bringing down fire from heaven, and that may be something that's out of the categories that we discuss in science, or it might be what we would call lightning, in which case it would be local weather. We will leave it at local weather at this particular point. Revelation 4:1 mentions angels over the four winds, and that might suggest some influence on regional or global weather. The passage in the Gospels pictures the demons controlling about 2,000 pigs, and are we to understand that they're doing one each, or can one demon control several pigs, or what's going on there, huh? Genesis 6, verses 1 through 4, we have the meeting of the sons of God and the daughters of men. What's going on there? That's a long discussion. I did a paper on that for the Grace Theological Journal some years back, and we might be looking at some kind of genetic manipulation in that sort of thing. The most likely sort of angelic activities would seem to be influencing people or events to change the course of human history, or perhaps something like doing genetic manipulation to change the course of biological history. The reason I pick these sorts of things is these are nice examples of where a small change, a small scale event, can have a large scale effect. And you remember the standard sort of thing that goes around about chaos theory, that the fluttering of a butterfly in China would a couple of weeks later have a big influence on the weather in the United States or something. Well, think then of some person dying at an inopportune moment or being able to strike a blow at a significant moment changing the course of human history, or doing something genetically that would change the course of biological history. I would be surprised if angelic beings could change any physical laws or constants. I'm not running the universe, however, but that's just my own take on this matter. So what would be the best places to search for some kind of what we might call scientific validation of angelic activities? Well, most likely, I would suggest the areas of history, since history studies long-term effects of intermittent actions. And the histories to look at would be the history of humans and the history of life. We're not here going to look into human history, except to suggest that very unusual coincidences, especially those that are either very beneficial or very disastrous, would be our best candidates for looking for this sort of thing. That is, not that they're the only places, but they're the most easy to see. We get back to the question of spotting cheating in a term paper or something. It's the most spectacular examples that are the easiest to spot, if you like. So, let's look at design in biology. Malevolent and benevolent. Charles Darwin, in a letter to Hooker, Joseph Hooker, in 1856, makes this remark. What a book a devil's chaplain might write on the clumsy, wasteful, blundering, low, and horribly cruel works of nature. If Darwin's feeling for this is reliable, he after all has studied biology for many years at this point, then this would suggest that malevolent intelligence may have been quite active in nature. Darwin is not arguing that way. He's arguing against a benevolent God explaining all of these events in nature. Having argued against it, the question is what you're going to put in place of it, and he put something natural in place of it. Darwin, writing to Asa Gray a few years later, says, there seems to be too much misery in the world. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the pneumonidae with the express intention of their feeding on with the living bodies of caterpillars, or that a cat should play with mice. Well, that gives us some examples, and we're not going to follow the cat-mice example, but a word or two about the pneumonidae. Ichneumon wasps represent a family of about 40,000 species. Some of these lay their eggs on or in the larva of an insect or a spider. The egg hatches, and the wasp larva devours the fats and body fluids of its host, but does it in a clever way so that the host does not die while the host is still needed. Is this behavior malevolent? Well, many of the insects it kills are pests to human farmers, so this is often beneficial to humans. From the perspective of the host caterpillar, however, it is certainly malevolent. So, suggestion, if what we're looking at there is sufficiently complex, functional, etc., to surpass what can happen by natural processes, then we may be looking at an example of malevolent intelligent activity. How about the actions of benevolent angels? Well, it'd be hard to distinguish their work from God's, since God does not need to exert all his power in any given direction, any given creation, excuse me. Perhaps angelic work might be recognized by being of imperfect design or limited scope. Well, an example that comes to mind here, a possible candidate, is the panda's thumb, a possible candidate for imperfect design with no signs of malevolence. Here, in a page from our cartoon book, What's Darwin Got to Do with It, a picture of a panda eating on bamboo shoots. The giant panda is a bear-like creature with an endangered species with only about 1,000 left in the wilds of Nepal and China. It eats the leaves, stems, and roots of the bamboo plant. Opposable thumbs, like humans and apes have, are useful for grasping. Gould, that'd be Stephen Jay Gould, points out that the panda's thumb, which it uses to strip leaves off the bamboo plants, is not a true thumb at all. It's a wrist bone that had been enlarged and given a set of muscles to do something similar. The panda has its 5 regular digits structured as a paw, typical of four-footed animals. Yet it also has an opposable thumb, which it uses with great efficiency to strip leaves from bamboo shoots, its primary food. Stephen Jay Gould, in his book, The Panda's Thumb, claims that this panda's thumb is proof of Darwinism. Imperfect design, he says, proves that the creative power at work is not intelligent. This is what Gould says. Ideal design is a lousy argument for evolution, for it mimics the postulated action of an omnipotent creator. Odd arrangements and funny solutions are the proofs of evolution, paths that a sensible God would never tread, but that a natural process constrained by history follows perforce. Well, it's arguable whether the panda's thumb is a poor design, but granting that it is, may it not be the work of genetic manipulation by angels who are constrained by history to work with what is available in the ancestral panda lineage rather than starting from scratch as God might. How about some other examples of malevolence, which is, after all, our major concern here? What about parasitic wasps, or parasitism in general, or predation in general, or disease? Parasitic wasps, Ichneumonidae, are only one of a large class of parasitic wasps, which employ many different strategies to attack their hosts. Picture here of the Haemophila. If these mechanisms contain irreducible complexity, which cannot be explained by unguided evolution, these too might be the work of malevolent spirits. What about parasitism? Parasitism is defined as a relationship in which the parasite does harm to the host. Perhaps parasitism in general, as opposed to benevolent forms of symbiosis, might be examples of malevolent design. What about predation? Could predation in general be malevolent design? This is how Darwin viewed the morality of predation. Though he, in his desire to remove intelligent design from nature, did not feel it was the action of moral agents. What about disease? This has always been a problem for some in believing that the benevolent God is in control of history. Consider two fierce diseases that were first encountered by humans in the late 20th century, AIDS and Ebola. AIDS, the acronym for Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome, is a viral disease that collapses the immune system of humans by destroying the cells called lymphocytes, which are crucial to its operation. The AIDS virus is too simple to live on its own. It must use the DNA copying mechanism of its host. But the AIDS virus is quite sophisticated in any case. Consider how it operates. First of all, AIDS enters the cell. The AIDS virus has co-receptors on its surface, which bind to the CD4 receptor on the lymphocyte surface. Thus, it is able to enter the human lymphocyte cell when it otherwise would be kept out. AIDS converts RNA to DNA. Once inside, the AIDS converts its RNA to DNA in order to use the human copying mechanism. This is done with a special enzyme in the AIDS virus, reverse transcriptase. The AIDS DNA is then inserted. Then the AIDS DNA must be inserted into the human DNA in order to be copied. But this requires another enzyme, an integrase. The AIDS DNA may now remain dormant until activated, perhaps by another enzyme. The AIDS virus is then assembled. Once the AIDS DNA has been activated, converted to RNA, and then proteins, a protease is needed to get the proteins in the form needed to assemble into AIDS viruses. AIDS virus released. At this point, the many copies of the AIDS virus are still inside one lymphocyte. But to infect any others, they need to get out. Another protein, TSG-101, is supplied for this purpose. Current statistics give 28 million deaths from AIDS in 20 years. About 65 million are thought to have contracted the disease to date. A fiendishly clever mechanism, don't you think? Ebola. The technical name for this disease is Ebola hemorrhagic fever. It is a fierce disease. It begins with weakness, fever, headache, muscle pain, and sore throat. It develops into vomiting, diarrhea, kidney and liver dysfunction, and bleeding, both internal and external. It ends in death for some 50 to 90% of the cases. Less is known about the Ebola mechanism than for the AIDS mechanism, but we do know that the Ebola cell docks with the cell membrane. Viral RNA is released into the cytoplasm of the membrane of the cell. It directs the production of viral proteins and genetic material. Viral genomes are coated with a protein to make cores. The cores migrate to the cell surface. Transmembrane protein spikes are produced and ferried to the cell surface. The cores push through the cell membrane, taking membrane and spikes along as they exit the cell. What about cure for Ebola? Currently, there is no known cure. The only treatment is to keep the patient as comfortable as possible, to use extreme care to prevent the disease from spreading. You can see the equipment these guys are wearing, which can occur from contact with the patient or any of his or her body fluids. Ebola statistics. The first case of Ebola were recognized in 1976. All known deaths so far have been in Africa. As of 2002, some 1,643 cases have been reported. 1,152 have died. The average fatality rate is 70%. Well, that's our tour. We come back to summarize things. You remember our proposal. Those ancients who believe that angels produced all the phenomena of weather, disease, and insanity we thought were mistaken. But so too are those moderns who believe that angels are mythological or that angels produce no effect in the natural world. Our suggestion is rather that angels exist and are able to and do interact with nature. Conclusions, if our suggestions are valid, this will have serious consequences for doing historical forms of science. If it is true that supernatural beings have significantly intervened in the history of biology, it will not do to ignore such causes by the use of methodological naturalism. It is, of course, needful that someone with substantial biological training should investigate this question carefully, and they're not likely to get government support for that. They are likely to run into ridicule for that. Can't do much for you, except to suggest that it's a job that needs to be done, and may the Lord raise up someone to do it. This particular question has some ramifications for the problem of evil as well. A positive answer to our proposal would have an impact on the philosophical problem of natural evil, considered by many atheists their best argument against the existence of God. The atheist philosopher Brian Marston, for example, dismisses this alternative with the following comments. However, he says, while the thesis that fallen angels are responsible for natural evil is not clearly false, neither is it clearly true. There is no positive evidence that such beings exist, and an argument based on their existence cannot be highly cogent. If the possibility that natural evil stems from the free choice of an agent other than man is disregarded on these grounds, then neither man nor a free-willed agent other than man can be held accountable for natural evil. Therefore, the theist must attribute natural evil to the direct action of God. Well, there are other ways to respond to the problem of evil than the one here, but suggestion is that this should be looked into. So, an invitation. We end this talk with a call to some dedicated Christian historians and biologists to take some time, risk some ridicule, to see whether there's any evidence for taking the biblical pictures of angels, demons, and Satan seriously as a picture of the real world, rather than merely an ancient mythological worldview.